Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio with Politics Uncensored. Another great episode for everybody this week. We've got a little bit of an international episode. Both guests from across the world, as well as an MP here in the UK. We're going to focus this week on the theme of India. And many of you will have heard or seen on the news the rising tensions amongst communities in India, particularly amongst Hindu and Muslim communities. And while that may seem really, really far away, we have seen it come to our shores in the UK. If you take your mind back a couple of months, you will have seen, hopefully you will have seen, the headlines around tensions in Leicester. And how that links all the way back to India. So what we're going to do is we're going to try and get some perspectives on what's actually going on and how that links back home here in the UK. And so we're going to be joined by Muhammad Ali, an author and academic from India. He's going to tune in live with us from India and tell us a little bit about the history, the context, but also what's going on in India. How can we delve through all of the headlines and get to the issues in the roots of the communities. Later, we'll be joined by Naz Shah, MP, Labour MP for Bradford West and Vice Chair of the APPG on British Muslims. She has spoken about this issue in Parliament on a number of occasions, and obviously we'll have people within her constituency and people she's met across the country who are both directly and indirectly affected by this. But as we do every week, we start with This Week Unwrapped, and that's the segment where we are joined by a guest where we talk about the headlines of the week's news. And we have a returning guest this week, Councillor Hamza Tuazel, our former Lord Mayor of Westminster, who joined us previously. Hamza, thanks so much for coming back. I'm told you're in Morocco.
I am. I'm currently in Morocco, literally just moved away from the family lunch to jump on. And yeah, it's really hot here, though.
Well,
it's
listen, I appreciate you stepping away from that what I can only imagine is amazing Moroccan food to talk to me. Makes me feel particularly special. And I don't know if you can see behind me, but it's been horrible weather in London today. So I'm well jealous of you. It's this sort of misty rain, the horrible sort of rain as well. It doesn't even have the audacity to rain properly. Anyway, we're going to start with something you'll be familiar with, and that's Notting Hill Carnival. We've had lots of controversy surrounding Notting Hill Carnival as a result of comments made both by the Metropolitan Police and by politicians. So the Metropolitan Police Federation has said that there was unacceptable and unsustainable levels of violence at Notting Hill Carnival that just took place over the bank holiday weekend. We now have seen reports that a police officer was sexually assaulted and six others were bitten this year, while footage has emerged of youth running through the streets with machetes. Rick Pryor, Vice Chairman of the Federation, said the levels of violence at the carnival in recent years has become unmanageable. Now, obviously, Notting Hill Carnival is a staple of London. It's a huge, huge cultural moment that celebrates the diversity of our city and the amazing the Caribbean culture that exists and is so deep-rooted in our city. It's one of the most enjoyable times of year to be a Londoner, and yet we've got quite a lot of outcry, particularly from far-right media, but not just exclusive to far-right media. Hamza, you are a councillor and were a former Lord Mayor in one of the most diverse boroughs in London. Tell us a little bit about your views on what's being said around Notting Hill Carnival, but also what it represents in our city.
Well, I think in terms of Notting Hill Carnival, it's quite tricky. You do have sort of the racists and the far right who say, oh, we don't like it, it's a lot of noise, a lot of disturbance, nothing's really community orientated about it. But the reality is, and obviously since its inception, it has been a community event. It's been a time for different cultures, different people from all over to get together, especially the Caribbean culture, to be able to express themselves, have a bit of fun. And I think it has been in recent years especially, overshadowed from some of the things you see with the police or with, I guess, a bit of knife crime or some of the youth issues that are happening over the last couple of years. It goes right through, well, it goes at the end of my ward as a Queen's Park councillor, then enters Westbourne. So it's all partly Westminster, partly Kent and Chelsea. So we do see it from the very beginning to the very end.
Do you think that there needs to be more done to kind of develop a better relationship between the police force and organizers and community members? Could that be part of what's going wrong here?
No, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. I don't think there's a sense of trust and understanding between organizers and the police force. And I don't think it has been for actually quite a while. I can't remember the last time there was, I think, quite peaceful and positive cooperation. Now, that's not saying there isn't any cooperation. There is, and there are good people on both sides, obviously, who try to make things happen. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, it's people talking. I guess I'm talking to a wall and you're talking to a wall, and we don't get anywhere, essentially. And yeah. I think we've seen that, especially this year, of all the coverage that's taken place.
And so, lastly on this issue, Susan Hall, who's the Conservative Party candidate for London Mayor at the next mayoral election, has been heavily criticised for what many viewers' offensive comments in regards to Notting Hill Carnival. She suggested that it should be moved. There were controversies, reports around her comments allegedly saying, linking it to crime. And obviously that's seen huge outcry. The likes of David Lammy have spoken against it, and Labour MPs have written a letter. How important do you think it is for a London mayoral candidate to understand just how important Carnival is in connecting different communities across the UK and in London specifically?
I think in terms of any mayoral candidate, they need to understand what London's really about. They need to understand what it actually means for the communities involved, what it means for the people who live in the area, what it means for the people who take part in the area. And unfortunately, and this is not me just saying it from a sort of political standpoint, but the comments that she makes or she has made in the past, and politicians like her, I don't know how much they really care about the community. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much they really care about making a difference and making a change. And yeah. I think for them, they have a very black and white view of it. And it's literally, they're stop the carnival.
Yeah, and it seems a little bit like it's just playing to a base that's become more and more toxic in our politics over the years, because London Carnival brings people together regardless of party affiliation, right? And it's not just Caribbean communities. Obviously, it's a celebration of Caribbean culture, but it's communities all across London that come together.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's what Carnival has been.
And so we've spoken about police. We're gonna carry on, and that's the next story, and that's that police officers found guilty of gross misconduct face automatic dismissal, while all staff who fail vetting can be sacked under government reforms of the disciplinary system. The measures are an attempt to restore the public's faith in policing in the wake of numerous controversies, including serving firearm officer Wayne Cousins being convicted of the kidnap, rape and murder of Sarah Everard. Hamza, we're not going to spend too much time on this, but I just want to get your views on this. Obviously, after Sarah, the tragic case of Sarah Everard, what was being said is all police officers should be vetted before they're allowed, at least certainly firearms officers, but before they're allowed to be officers. And that seems like the direction we're going in. What's your view on that?
So I think it tackles one side of the problem, but doesn't necessarily solve what the issue is here. And the issue is that there is a culture within the police force, unfortunately, of this sort of racism, discrimination, of these, and I don't want to say sort of predators, but there's people with serious issues who seem to go through all the vetting and come out on the other side as police officers, are meant to protect us, are meant to serve us, are meant to help us out when we need them. So I think that's an easy cop-out to say, once you've made a mistake, we're going to get rid of you, because then they've already made a mistake. So you sort of question what the government's actually trying to do here, and whether it's with good intentions or not.
Yeah, and our final story here is on the theme of the show today. We're going to be having a number of guests joining us later to really unpick this. But it's surrounding India. So police in India are investigating a video that shows a school teacher telling her pupils to slap their 7-year-old Muslim classmate. The boy is filmed in tears as he's slapped, allegedly for getting his times tables wrong. The video went viral on social media and has triggered widespread dismay and condemnation. India's opposition leader Rahul Gandhi blamed the government for stoking religious intolerance. The incident happened on Thursday at private school in Uttar Pradesh, a northern state. "Why are you hitting me so lightly? Hit him hard," the teacher is heard telling the children as the boy stands crying. I don't know if you've seen this. It's been all over TikTok and Twitter and other places. I don't want to talk about the incident specifically, because often with these things, you can't fact check, you can't verify. It's a social media clip. But what we're doing is, I think what we want to do is use that clip as a sort of a segue or a pivot into what is going on in India and these tensions between Muslim and Hindu communities and the rise of Modi and the far right. what is your perspective on the rise of tensions between these communities in India, but also, as I said at the top of the show, it really is coming back home, as we saw in Leicester and other things, and in other places in the UK.
Yeah, well, I did see this particular thing on I say social media. I saw it on TikTok a couple of times, and it was going around sort of with the little group chats and that sort of thing. But I think it's worrying, and I say that with sort of great concern, because India is a sort of extremely polarized country at the moment. You do have Modi, you do have people who are against that sort of coexistence. And that has always, I think, been the case for India since the British left. It has always been like that. And I'd even go as far to say it was purposefully left like that in order to allow those divisions to occur. But what we see within India, with the splits in faiths, the splits in that sort of community relations, it does bring it back home. We've seen it here.
And so as a councillor, are you worried that we could see some of these, obviously probably not to the extremes that we're seeing in India, but some of these behaviours and patterns and tensions in your own ward, own council and in our city?
I think I've definitely seen it in some cultures where they bring politics from back home into the UK. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily just sort of the violence or the outrage and that sort of thing. But they genuinely bring back like political parties and their sort of political influence, and they have it in the UK. So you'd have someone who perhaps isn't an elected individual, isn't involved in the political system at all, who's supposedly in charge and runs their community, runs their area.
And then when you go and obviously some things are political norms abroad that aren't necessarily in the UK, and often it's not always a bad thing, but it's things we need to be cognizant of. Hamza, I'm going to let you go back because I took you away from food, and I'm feeling increasingly guilty every minute I've been taking you away from the food.
Sorry about the disturbance.
No disturbance at all. Thank you for having us. Thank you for joining us from Morocco. I'm sure I'll hear from you soon and send my salams to the family and enjoy your time away. We're going to be staying on. That was Councillor Hamza Tazel, former Lord Mayor of Westminster. But we're going to be staying on the topic of India. And the rising tensions between Hindu and Muslim communities in India, and what that means for us in the UK, and whether we could see that take place here. I'm going to start by playing you a clip. And that clip is by a gentleman by the name of Subramania Swamy, a leader of the BJP party. And he was recorded on Vice for a documentary saying this.
I mean, there's 200 million Muslims living in India. That's the second largest Muslim population in the world. And you're saying that wherever Muslims live, there's a problem?
If Muslims become more than 30%, that country is in danger.
That sounds like hatred. That sounds like language of hatred.
It's easy to say hatred. I'm being kind to them by not letting them come to India.
Article 14 of the Indian Constitution guarantees the right to equality, as you know, for all persons living in India.
I can tell you that's a misinterpretation of Article 14. Article 14 guarantees equality of equals. I'll give you an example.
Are all people not equal?
All people are not equal.
Muslims do not deserve equal rights to apply for citizenship.
There's no such thing as equal rights. They're not in an equal category.
There you have a leader of the ruling BJP party in India claiming that Muslims are not equals and should not even be brought into the conversation around equality of the law. Now, India, which has long had a secular constitution prior to the most recent years, is obviously under heavy scrutiny. And the reason it's under heavy scrutiny is one of two things. Largely, we have a quite large Indian-British population in the UK. We have a quite large Muslim British population in the UK, and there's obviously crossover with Indian, Muslim, British people here in the UK. But also India is going to be one of the biggest economic powers that exist in the world. We have seen cabinet ministers and even the prime minister talking about the importance of future trade deals with India. Well, we need to look at these trade deals and any future relationship based on the behaviours of the Indian government, as we do with any government, and the morality around that. Now, there are around 200 million Muslims currently living in India, making it one of the largest Muslim populations anywhere in the world. But they are a minority in a predominantly Hindu country. And for decades, Muslim communities have faced discrimination in employment, education, and encountered barriers to achieving wealth and political power. However, this has heightened under the leadership of Prime Minister Narendra Modi and the ruling party, the BJP, who have pursued a Hindu nationalist agenda since their rise to power in 2014. Modi's re-election in 2019 has seen the BJP push controversial policies to ignore Muslims' rights and disenfranchise millions of Muslims across India, and has led to a rise in violence against Muslims all across India and across its states. Now, one of the major first bits of news that really hit our airwaves in the West was in 2019, in December, Narendra Modi signed a Citizenship Amendment Act, which looked at fast-tracking citizenship for Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, Jains, Parsis, and Christians, to the exclusion of Muslims. And it was the first time that a religion was directly linked with citizenship in Indian law. Now, this was widely condemned. The UN Human Rights Council described the law as fundamentally discriminatory. And as a result, we have seen rising violence across India. Now, joining us in a moment, we're going to be having Muhammad Ali, author and academic in India, who's currently writing a book on the issue. He's going to talk to us about Narendra Modi, the BJP, the anti-Muslim mobs, and the rising violence and tensions across India. He's going to join us after this message.
FUBAR Radio presents Access
All Areas. There was an interesting no-show, I thought, in Harry Styles. Apparently he didn't come because both Olivia Wilde, his ex-girlfriend, and Emily Emrata was there too, and he was pictured kissing her recently in Japan.
Lucky care.
Apparently he avoided because best not to be around two women you've recently been with, I guess, if you're Harry Styles.
See, if I'd have been there, I'd have said to both of them, piss off. Harry, let's go and have a gin and tonic.
So joining us now, we have Count Binface, an independent space warrior. I just wanted to quickly ask you one last question. Let's say you had won that election and you became prime minister. You know, what are some of the big things you'd like to change? What are some of the big things you believe in that our politics needs?
Well, why don't we talk about the old royal family? Because, you know, I don't wish to abolish them like some people do. No. I merely wish to solidify their ceremonial role so that they become the living, breathing version of Madame Tussauds that deep down the public wants. The Dating
Show. Again, I've been out on dates where people have gone, oh, like, what do you do? Why do they want pictures? And then I'll just go, oh, listen, I'll do little bits on TV, that's it. And then 2 hours later, when they've had a few drinks, they stop going and say, tell me what happened with this girl. What happened with this? What happened with that? And I think I thought you didn't know.
Well, this is why I think I struggle with my date life, because I just see myself as me. You know, I'm from Oxford, moved to London. That's it. I have a great group of friends. That's as simple as my life is. When I go to date someone, I don't see myself as, oh, I'm a girl that works on TV. I just see myself as me. But then I'm reminded by some of the things that they might do.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio presents The Dating Show.
So we have got the incredible Sunita.
How does Sunita whittle down the people she wants to talk to the people she doesn't? What's your criteria?
Well, you've got to be an adult.
Okay.
That's always a good start.
Always a good start. But when I'm an adult, not just like 18, you've got to be like not young enough to be my child. You have to ideally be London-based, because I am. Yeah. Although I don't mind if you've got a country pad, that would be nice.
So at the minute, we're going with age and location are important.
Age and location are good.
Every Friday from 6 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio at Politics Uncensored. We're tackling a really serious, important international issue this week on our show, and that is the issue of rising tensions between communities in India. At the top of this segment, I played a little clip for listeners that really highlights the perspectives and the way of thinking, not by extremist individuals on the ground, but by political leaders. And this was what Subramania Swamy, a leader of the BJP party, said on Vice.
I mean, there's 200 million Muslims living in India. That's the second largest Muslim population in the world. And you're saying that wherever Muslims live, that's
if Muslims become more than 30%, that country is in danger.
That sounds like hatred. That sounds like language of hatred.
It's easy to say hatred. I'm being kind to them by not letting them come to India.
Article 14 of the Indian Constitution guarantees the right to equality, as you know, for all persons living in India.
I can tell you that's a misinterpretation of Article 14. Article 14 guarantees equality of equals. I'll give you an example.
Are all people not equal?
All people are not equal.
Muslims do not deserve equal rights to apply for citizenship.
There's no such thing as equal rights. They're not in an equal category.
There you hear a leader of the BJP party describing Muslims as quite explicitly not equals in his view, and not deserving of equal rights across the law. Earlier when we spoke to Hamza, I referred to a video of a school child being slapped, but we've also got another report from the New York Times around a separate issue on a train in Mumbai, India's commercial capital, where a police officer took up his rifle, fatally shot his superior, and then killed three unarmed passengers. All three of the passengers were Muslim men, according to Indian news reports. And audio from the cell phone videos of the incident filmed inside the train is muffled, but it sounds as if the officer, Chetan Singh, says in Hindi, "If you want to live in Hindustan, you must vote for Modi and Yogi." Now, this is part of a growing concern in India, around the world, and in international institutions around rising tensions between Hindu and Muslim communities in India. Over 200 million Muslims currently live in India, but they are a minority in a predominantly Hindu country. Joining us now, we have Muhammad Ali, author who is currently writing a book about India under Narendra Modi. Mr. Ali, thank you so much for joining us live from India, I understand. How are you doing today? Sorry. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well. Thank you so much for joining us. I wondered, we've been talking a little bit around this rising tension between what seems to be Hindu nationalist far-right organizations and political parties and Muslim communities. Can you give our listeners, who may not know the history of India or how we got to today, a very brief sort of synopsis of how we have gotten to these rising tensions and to today?
Well, Ali, it's I won't use the term tensions, you know, because tensions suggest that there is a reciprocity of animosity between two communities. You know, this term describes the situation in India, say, 20 years ago. Right now, what we are seeing is it's one-sided attack on the rights of minorities, including Muslims, mainly Muslims and Christians in India. And it's a one-sided attack. The fact of the matter is that Muslim life in India has become dangerously uncertain, you know? And Hindus have been radicalized to such an extent that now you do not need organized violence. There was a time when communal riots, communal violence, mob violence was used to attack Muslims. And these mob violence would happen periodically. Say 2002 massacre of Muslims in Gujarat, when under the watch of Prime Minister who was at that time Chief Minister of Gujarat, under his nose, and he has been accused of not doing anything, in fact, allowing the Hindu mob to kill thousands of Muslims in his state. So there was a time when mob violence, like 2002 anti-Muslim violence, would be used to polarize the population and win elections. And there is a political scientist called Paul Bras who used the term as he used communal violence as saying that these are instruments of violence. But right now what's happening is that we don't need to organize, we don't need organized violence. Why? Because Hindus have been radicalized to such an extent that the very idea of Muslims, they see the very idea of Muslims, the very idea of Christians as a threat to their culture, to Indian culture.
If I can stop you on that idea of threat, because I want our listeners to get a good sense, because they're not in India, get a good sense of where this threat idea is coming from. From what we have seen in the research and in the data and the news reports here, there is very much an idea and a fear that Muslims' populations...
Ali,
and
can you be a bit louder, please? Or should I use...
Well, I can try and speak louder. Can you hear me okay like this?
Yeah.
So basically, what I wanted to ask is this threat a fear of Muslim populations growing at a high rate in India?
The threat of fear against fear about Muslims?
Yes.
Yeah. See, the thing is that Hindus are being... okay. So as you asked me, initially that to give you a sense of what's going on. So, and I just wanted to come to that, you know, Hindutva or Hindu nationalism or Hindu majoritarianism was to a very small degree in India's blood anyway, you know, right from partition to say 20 years ago. So there we would generally see here and there, you know, mob violence, attacks on Muslims, and they used to be, you know, not very often. They were not a phenomena as such, but. So what has happened right now is that because the seeds of religious bigotry plaguing this country, it was planted a century ago, you know, as far back as 1921, when the All India Hindu Mahasabha at its very inception pronounced that Hindus need a separate nation and Muslims must be denied any rights in it. That fuzzy notion of Hindu nationalism was formalized by this ideologue, Hindutva ideologue, called V.D. Savarkar. He, as an exclusivist and homogenizing doctrine called Hindutva, that is underpinned by an obsessive, visceral hatred of Muslims. Now, when partition happened in 1947, a large number of Muslims migrated to Pakistan, and some of the Muslims in India decided to stay back. Now, the Muslims who decided to stay back, they bear the burden of this partition. And the right wing has been asking them, that they use this logic that when you got your land, why the hell are you here? So this logic, this idea that Muslims belong to Pakistan has been successfully pushed in the minds and the psyche of the Hindu community in India. And the Hindutva, the Hindu nationalist groups, they've succeeded in capturing the collective consciousness of a large section of Hindus and indoctrinating them in the gospel of this Hindu supremacy.
Could you, Mr. Ali, quickly tell us a little bit about the role that Narendra Modi has played in all of this?
Well, Narendra Modi, since... when he became chief minister, he became infamous because by the violence, anti-Muslim violence under him, which happened, you know, when he was the chief minister or what we call the governor. Mm-hmm.
He was denied a visa to the United States at the time,
because of this. Yeah, so he was denied a visa because of the human rights record. A bad human rights record under him, and he was denied. Interestingly, you know, I mean, you'll be surprised to know that he was a banned guy. He was a persona non grata till he became the prime minister, and he could visit the United States only because he became the prime minister of India. So he is the guy who manifested as the guy who used these fault lines between Hindus and Muslims, these historical fault lines, to polarize the Hindus. And of course, he sprinkled a bit the notion of development along with it to woo the upper middle class.
So he's used also, these tensions essentially as a political tool.
Yeah. But when he won the elections in 2014, strategically he didn't use violence at that time as a political tool. He used symbolism at that time. Now the idea of violence as a widespread tool of polarization and violence to win elections, to polarize the Hindus and win elections, even when the economy is doing very bad, even when India is doing terrible in all development in indices, and in every way, Modi government used violence against Muslims, lynchings, starting from 2015, when one of the first lynchings under Modi happened on the rumors of a Muslim having eaten beef. He was lynched by his friends and neighbors in which was like in a place right outside the national capital. And that's when it was from 2015 onwards that the violence and instruments of violence was used. Mm-hmm. As an instrument to kind of polarize.
And we also saw, I think I've got here, the New Delhi clashes in 2020, which saw around 50 people killed, mostly Muslims. And there were allegations that the police did not intervene to stop the mobs attacking Muslims. And in fact, one of the things you said earlier, it's not just you saying it. Ghazal Jamil, assistant professor at a university in India, has said the idea was that if you were a Muslim, you were liable to be attacked anywhere, any time in India. And so I wondered if you could give us perspective to our listeners, what life is like for an Indian Muslim right now. Are they at risk of violence at any point in their life?
Well, if you are, I mean, I won't go on to say that it's, they can be attacked anywhere, but a Muslim, especially a visible Muslim, a Muslim with a cap, with a beard, who looks like Muslim, is certainly dangerous. It's dangerous to be a visible Muslim in today's India. And as you were rightly mentioned, talking about this incident of a murder of Muslims in a train, when I joined, I heard you talking about it. Hello.
Yes, yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. So, you know, that policeman, he killed two Muslims, and they were visible Muslims. So right now, Muslims have stopped. They're very cautious not to appear as Muslims in day-to-day lives. Like they've stopped wearing skull caps. They've stopped saying Assalamu Alaikum in public spaces. They've stopped eating meat in public spaces. And what has happened is that every idea and everything associated with Muslims have been illegitimized and have been criminalized in India today. Like, you can't eat like a Muslim, you can't fall in love, you can't live wherever you want, you can't eat what you want. It's almost like what was happening in Nazi Germany, when everything, every association of being a Jew was publicly, mm-hmm. Delegitimized and criminalized. Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested that you've brought up that issue, because one of my simplest questions to you was going to be, would you see Narendra Modi as an out and out fascist?
Well, it's not only, Ali, it's very easy to blame Modi, and it's very easy to just say, okay, Modi is out and out fascist. Of course he is. But we should also talk about the ideology propelling him. Because if Modi goes, we have a guy who is waiting to replace him, and he's far, far worse than Modi. His name is Yogi Adityanath. He's a right-wing radical priest. And he was appointed as chief minister.
Yeah, I have a quote here from Mr. Adityanath where he says, where he's talking about law and order, and he says, feeding bullets, not biryani, to Muslim troublemakers.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So he has told several times that Muslims should stop asking for rights on mosques, and he has in all ways and choices he has showed that he is a chief minister of Hindus. Mm-hmm. For him, interests of Hinduism and Hindus comes first, and the rights of being a Muslim, rights of being a Muslim as an equal citizen of the country and guaranteed by the Constitution of India comes later.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Ali, I just want to ask you, I think it's really important to touch this topic, and that is, I don't want to associate what is very clearly a wide-scale radicalization to all Hindus in India and thus around the world, in any more than I would like as a Muslim to be associated, for example, with the behaviors of Saudi Arabia or other Muslim countries. Can you tell us a little bit about what sort of resistance there is in India by Hindu communities who may not be agreeing with what is being done by the government?
Well, it's just a very small minority, the so-called secular liberal left, that has become a fringe right now. It's an echo chamber. They protest against the right-wing Hindutva. They protest against the Modi government's anti-Muslim policies. But that protest in an echo chamber works only for the benefit of Modi's polarization. The more left liberal lobbies, left liberal groups protest against Modi, the more the support base of Modi becomes emboldened, and they become, they don't have any qualms, you know.
And I imagine there's also a fear, right? If that violence that is being inflicted amongst Muslims could be turned on communities who are seen as against this nationalistic far right ideology.
Yeah, it's already happening. Like Christians are being, attacked on daily basis. Their prayers, their churches, any semblance of Christian prayer anywhere in the rural India is being attacked, and these people are being, like, Christians, pastors and priests are being arrested in the past, and it's happening on daily basis across the country because Hindus think that, oh, these are missionaries who are converting Hindus into Christians. And that, what has happened is that Modi's chief ministers, Modi's party, whichever state it is governing, they have passed an anti-conversion law, which is being used against Christian as well as Muslim priests.
Yeah, can I ask, you're speaking about speaking out about this live on our show from India, not just yourself but people like yourself. How much of a precarious, dangerous situation is it for you and people like you who are speaking out against Modi and the government and the nationalistic movement?
Well, honestly, Ali, I'm not very vocal on social media because anyone who speaks against the government, who is seen as very vocal, gets arrested. The cases are registered against them. I am just like speaking to you because I hope that not many right wing Hindus listen to your podcast, and they don't file a case against me. But the reality is that speaking against this government, speaking against the culture of violence, which is against Muslims and Christians, which has been normalized in today's India, anyone who speaks against that is seen as a threat. And police arrest them. And what has happened is that there's a there are two laws. One is for Hindus and one for Muslims. You know, if a Hindu, right-wing Hindu goon who has killed Muslims, like innocent Muslims, who burnt Muslims, if he has not been arrested yet, he's still there, he's online, he's talking to the media, but he has not been arrested. But if there is any guy who gets who tweets against Hindu nationalism, against this violence, mm-hmm. or who counters the fake news spread by the right-wing Hindu groups, mm-hmm. he gets arrested and they don't get bail.
And so, we certainly don't want any difficulty coming to you. The reason we want to talk about this on our show, I mean, we're a UK-based, British, mostly European show. The reason we want to talk about it is because India is being seen as one of the big trade deal Britain wants to do, given the size of the Indian economy.
The FTA is in its last leg. The discussion is in last legs, mm-hmm. and it will be formalized, let's say, by October, November.
Yeah, and so one of the things we want is we want our decision makers here in the UK to hear exactly the behaviours of the current Indian administration, what is facing Muslims in India. And so, assume, as I usually do, that you have British politicians listening into what you're saying right now, the Prime Minister, cabinet members, members of the opposition, what would your call to them be surrounding India? What should they be doing surrounding India?
Well, I, you know, the only thing I would ask them is to pressurize the Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government to uphold the rights of the press in India, to uphold the rights of minorities, including Muslims and Christians. See, as a realist, I also think that beyond a point, it doesn't matter, because Modi government does not care that much about the foreign governments and foreign governments. Let's take up Biden administration. The Biden administration, State Department's commission on the religious rights of minorities, it has been calling for last 3-4 years to declare India as a country of particular concern when it comes to the religious rights of minorities. And it has been asking the State Department and the Biden administration to consider India as a country as similar to Saudi Arabia. But the Biden administration has been, you know, welcoming Modi with pomp and show, as you can see. So I don't think much is going to change. But, you know, answer to your question, I would certainly hope once the Labour Party comes in power, they do exercise some kind of pressure on Modi government not to harass Muslims and Christians and not to kill them.
Yeah. You know. Well, I don't know how many, like you mentioned earlier, I don't know how many far right sort of people within the Indian nationalist movement listen to the show, but I do know that people from the Labour Party certainly listen to the show, and I hope they've heard you loud and clear. Thank you so much, Muhammad Ali. Very brave of you to speak. All the power to you for speaking out. Good luck with your book. That was Muhammad Ali, author who is currently writing a book about India under Narendra Modi. We're going to be joined by Naz Shah MP, Labour MP for Bradford, after this message.
FUBAR Radio presents As Handsome As You Imagine.
What did you have for breakfast that morning?
Almost certainly a pie.
For breakfast?
Yeah, because we started really, really early, right, at the butcher's. Yeah. We started proper early, like 7 o'clock. I would have had at least 6 pies.
A day?
A day.
That is a lot of pies.
No, because we sold them at the shop.
That is a legitimate answer to the question, who ate all the pies? Yeah.
From 1 p.m. every Monday.
FUBAR Radio presents
Harriet Rose.
Amber Mark's here.
As I was saying, the visuals on Love Be Right, it was kind of like Lady in the Water, like, you know, that old painting.
That was pretty crazy, being in that pink
plastic pool with like milk and like pink food dye and jello, I think.
So to us it looks really sexy, and then you're just sat in there like, what?
It was very cold.
Very cold and very gloopy.
Yeah.
Did you pee in the pool?
No, I did not. I didn't.
Promise me.
I swear I didn't, because there was the guy who was doing, he was holding the camera. I felt really bad. He was in the pool with me, so I didn't want to pee in the pool.
Oh, so that's the only reason you didn't pee in the pool, because there was another guy there.
I didn't want to do that.
He's suddenly like, oh, did someone put some warm water in here? Kind of a yellowy hue.
Every Thursday,
Harriet Rose.
From 4 p.m. FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio, our Politics Uncensored. We've been tackling a really quite difficult situation. We've just heard from an author, Muhammad Ali, from Live from India, as we discuss the level of violence. I think he quite rightly pulled me up on not using the word tensions. The level of violence facing particularly Muslim communities, but also Christians in India at the hands of a far-right extremist organizations. I said it during the interview, and I want to say it again. As with anything like this, whether we're talking about, you know, far-right nationalist organizations and political parties and mobs in India, or whether we talk about the Taliban in Afghanistan, or even extremist, you know, European Christian racist organizations in Europe, it's really important that we don't associate these extremists with the groups as a whole. And that's Hindus, Hindu Indians, or Hindus across the world as a whole. They're no, you know, these far right organizations are no more representative of them than the Taliban is of Muslims, or certain far right Nazi groups are of Christians in the UK. And it's really important that our listeners remember that, because some of the things we're talking about are very difficult and haunting. And you heard Muhammad Ali when I spoke to him about the backlash that he receives or is likely to receive or could possibly receive as a result of speaking out, that we make those distinctions, that we don't fall into racist traps ourselves of homogenizing communities, whether that's in a specific country or here at home. But we have been talking about the levels of violence, the oppression, and the systematic persecution of Muslims in India as a result of far-right extremist Hindu nationalist organizations and political parties. And Muhammad Ali linked those directly to Narendra Modi and others. And he was careful to let us know that this is an ideology that has been spreading across India for many, many years. The New York Times has done a number of pieces on this issue. A few years ago, they looked at the detention centers that were supposedly being built to house what they or what many believed was to be targeting Muslims. I mean, they spoke about foreigners, but the idea was that these detention centers were being built for Muslims. These were denied by Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister. He called them lies, lies, lies. And yet the New York Times was able to get on the ground and not only find these detention centers, but send footage of people working on them. You can find these videos online where even people working on the sites were talking about building really high walls so people won't be able to get out. Le Monde, a French newspaper, has reported quite extensively on this issue. And they have, quote, said that Hindu extremists are hunting down Muslims with impunity. Far-right Hindu organizations have begun hunting down Muslim families. And a quote from a youth member of an organization called Vishwa Hindu Parishta, which is an extremist group that has allegedly, according to Le Monde, been linked to the same ideological family. So not directly, but same ideological family as PM Modi. A quote from a youth member of this that's quoted in Le Monde stated that almost 100% of the violence against Muslims is justified. And as a result of this rising hatred towards Muslims and this radicalization, anti-Muslim mobs have become so common that the Indian Supreme Court has themselves warned that they may become the new normal. That's the Indian Supreme Court claiming that anti-Muslim mobs may become the new normal across India. Now, we've spoken about a number of different cases. One was a teacher that you may have seen on TikTok and Twitter and Instagram. Or I'm supposed to say X now, not Twitter. Where a teacher is telling students to slap a Muslim student. But the New York Times, amongst others, has also highlighted a case that I spoke to Muhammad Ali about, which was in the early hours of a Monday on a train bound for Mumbai, India's commercial capital. A police officer took up his service rifle, fatally shot his superior, and then killed three unarmed passengers. All three of the passengers were reportedly Muslim men, according to Indian news reports. Audio from the cell phone videos of the incident filmed inside the train is muffled, but it sounds as if the officer, Chetan Singh, says in Hindi, "If you want to live in Hindustan, you must vote for Modi and Yogi." And you can find that on the New York Times website. And obviously, this is a concern for us, not just from a moral perspective, but from a political perspective here in the UK. We've seen this violence travel across the world and has reached Leicester. Someone who has spoken very, very clearly against this issue in the Houses of Parliament is Naz Shah, Labour MP for Bradford West and Vice Chair of the APPG on British Muslims. Naz, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, good evening.
I hope you can hear us. Thanks so much. I appreciate your time. We have been spending this programme talking about the rising violence against Muslims in India. We've heard from someone live from India who's writing a book on the case. And we've seen a number of different reports from the New York Times and other places around the scale of violence and persecution against Muslims in India. You're the APPG, you're the Vice Chair of the APPG for British Muslims. You've also spoken about this issue in Parliament. How concerned are you at the rising normalization of violence against Muslims in India?
Well, I'm deeply concerned. First of all, thank you, and it's good to be with you this evening. Look, we've seen the thing that went viral a couple of days ago about a teacher having children getting up and slapping a Muslim boy. And, you know, people, the media, and it's interesting to see the tweets on that, because some of the media are saying, oh, this is horrendous. But these are the media people who have, you know, at times inflamed this and normalised this kind of violence. And Shashi Tharoor's tweet was interesting. He said we should all, every Indian should be hanging their heads in shame. Those were the words of their elected member, Shashi Tharoor, who was at one point the Deputy General Secretary of the United Nations. It's not something that has not been talked about. It's not something that we don't know is happening. We know that it's increasing. We know that violence against Muslims, the issue with the hijab at the schools, the issue with what girls are wearing, has been, you know, the lynching of Muslims in India. And I'm deeply concerned. My concern grows, you know, by the day, because there doesn't seem to be anybody who's speaking out, apart from when there's something that goes viral and then maybe a few people will, you know, come in on the issue. But I'm also worried about the persecution of, you know, not just Muslims, but other minorities in India as well. There seems to be this attitude that nobody can speak against it because it's Modi and because of trade deals, etc. And that is really, really worrying me.
And I'm glad you've raised that, because that's one of the issues, one of the reasons we wanted to do the show, is obviously because India is going to be seen as a potential trade partner. We've heard Rishi Sunak talk about it, amongst others. How important is it that we maintain in the public consciousness and in the public conversation that while trade deals are being discussed with India, there are 200 million Muslims who many are being lynched, killed, persecuted, having their hijabs ripped off? How important is it for politicians like yourself to bring that to the forefront?
I think it's really important, because I remember when Boris Johnson, when we had COVID, you might remember that India was not placed on the red list despite the variant that was really, really prevalent. And at the time, because it was India, they renamed the variant and started giving variants names. Now, that was telling. And Boris Johnson planned to go to India during that month. And it was catastrophic for Indians, you know, the amount of COVID that there was there. But Boris Johnson did not put a India on the red list until it was such a big crisis, and it shouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. In comparison, Pakistan, which had relatively, and not just Pakistan, other countries, which had relatively lower numbers of COVID cases, were put onto the red list of no-flying during COVID pandemic. And when Boris Johnson did finally get to India, I remember tweeting one single tweet to Boris Johnson saying, I hope you're going to be discussing the issues of human rights abuses in India. And I had, Ali, I had, they had panel interviews with people dissecting who Naz Shah was, that because I was of Pakistani heritage, somehow I was, you know, a Pakistani stooge or whatever they were.
Yeah.
But I was my the abuse that I got on Twitter after that one single tweet. And the truth is that politicians, we as politicians, whichever country it is, we need to be holding them to account, because if we are making trade deals with countries, they should be sharing the same values as us, and they should be sharing or at least aiming towards having a country which does not persecute minorities,
yep,
and which has equality. And that clearly isn't the case with India. Now, India as a country, an amazing country, you know, I have many diaspora Indians living in my constituency, and many Indians are really, really appalled by what is happening, and they speak up against it. But this whole BJP kind of narrative is very, very worrying. And I wish India all the best in terms of economic prosperity. It's a very, very important country. We should absolutely be developing really, really strong ties with India and countries that we can trade with, and we can, you know, we have Indians who come here, who work in the NHS, who work. So that's the crucial component of our relationship.
But
cannot be at the expense of human rights violations.
Exactly, and I think one of the reasons it's important to speak about is also because trade negotiations and deals are moments in which you can influence other countries. And if this is a moment where we can talk about these issues, then I think it's really, really important. Naz, I just want to say before I let you go, because we are running out of time, I said this to Muhammad as well, Muhammad Ali, who joined us earlier. It takes a lot of courage to speak about this issue, because as you've rightly said, as soon as you've finished talking to us today and this goes out, I'm sure there's going to be a barrage of abuse. Muhammad Ali actually mentioned that he hoped people weren't listening within India, so he wasn't targeted. So I want to thank you for having the courage to speak out about this issue to us and elsewhere that you've been able to have. I'm sure it'll have a huge impact for Muslims in India and across the country.
Thank you very much for having me on, and thank you for having this conversation, because we had Aditya Roy here, who delivered the three-word lecture at Bradford Literature Festival. And she talked about her courage. She talked about me talking and getting trolled on media, social media, is nothing, is not even a drop in the ocean in comparison to what people on the ground in India are feeling, how she has been persecuted, how her family have been targeted economically, banking-wise, you know. And she comes from a comfortable position. Nobody will employ her. She's put her pieces in the New York Times. Worth watching that lecture. I think it's on her free word lecture is on YouTube, and if not, find it on the Bradford Literature.
Yeah, I'm sure we can track that down and share it.
Keyword.
Okay, that's Naz Shah, Labour MP for Bradford West and Vice Chair of the APPG on British Muslims. Naz, thank you so much for joining us. We are approaching the end of our show today, and it's been a tough one, I think. Hearing some of the stories around what people are experiencing in India, some of the persecution, the violence, the death that is being experienced by Indians. But it's important that we raise it, largely because, as Naz said, there is a trade deal that is being negotiated, and trade deals are often the most influence you can have. The moments of trade deal negotiations are when you can have the most influence on a country, and it's important that we don't let this go silent for the Muslims in India, but as was rightly mentioned, other minorities, including Christians and the Indian voices, the Hindu voices in India, who are standing up to this far-right, nationalistic, racist agenda, politics, and oppression. Thank you all so much for joining me. I want to give a big thank you, particularly this week, to the bravery of Muhammad Ali, author and academic from India, who spoke to us, Naz Shah, Labour MP for Bradford West, and Councillor Hamza Tawazul, former Lord Mayor of Westminster, who's joined us as well. I have been Ali Milani. You can follow the show. Really do go back and listen to all of our other episodes. You can catch that on Fubar Radio on the website. Follow Fubar Radio on all the social media channels. We've done a host of really, really important issues like today, everything from policing to the NHS to the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. I even had Lord Buckethead on once. That was an experience. So you can go back and listen to all those episodes. On Instagram, we are at PoliticsFubar, same on Twitter/X. You can catch me on Twitter at AliMilaniUK and on Instagram. I will see you all next week. Salams.